Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. I am joined today by two of Bruegel's newest scholars. We have Mahmoud Pradhan, coming to Bruegel after a long career at the IMF, who's a non-resident fellow, and Andreas Billmeyer, a visiting fellow, coming to Bruegel after a long and varied career, which you can read all about on our website. All the bios are there. We're going to get right to it and talk today about the European Union's Spring 2026 Economic Outlook. The European Commission in Brussels puts out a forecast. The new one has just come out on the 21st of May, and it projected 1.1% GDP growth looking ahead. Andreas, tell us, what did we learn? Is the European economy holding on?
Barely, yes. Thanks a lot, Rebecca, for having me on this cast. I think the point, the number that you already mentioned is just a snapshot of what we're really looking at here. I think the revisions that we have seen are, if you look at it from a year-on-year basis, actually not that significant. That has to do partly with the fact that 2025 ended on a better note than the Commission thought. But two, it also depends very crucially on the assumptions underlying this forecast. And one of them is obviously what's going on in the Middle East, and in particular in the Strait of Hormuz, and how long the altercations there are going to continue. Just to follow up on the number that you mentioned, the growth rate has been revised lower. So for the Eurozone, I'm talking mostly about the Eurozone, we had 1.2 for 2026 in November last year. And that has been revised down to 0.9, so 30 basis points lower. But, and that's the important part here, the sequential growth rate has been significantly cut down. So before we were looking at quarters of 0.3s and 0.4s, and now we're really looking at quarters of 0.1s and 0.2s, so essentially a halving of the pace of growth. We can go more into detail there, but that is probably the quick takeaway just in terms of looking at the numbers, so the difference here is between year-on-year growth and sequential growth, which has been forecast to be slowing quite a bit.
And what about inflation and unemployment?
So on inflation, I would say that maybe the Commission, in my humble view, is not necessarily the key forecast of inflation. I would probably put a little bit more weight on what the ECB does in that context, and bring you also to another topic later. But the main point is that obviously, given the energy inflation, that's the key driver here, energy inflation is supposed to peak this year at 11% and remains above 10% for the rest of the year, inflation has been revised up, notably from 1.9 to 3.0 in 2026, and also a little bit in 2027, but I had it at 2.0, and that was revised up 4 to 2.3. So those are numbers for headline. And essentially, the similar argument for core, just a little bit less, that was revised up from 2.1 to 2.3 this year and 2.0 to 2.5, so more significant upward revision for 2027. So essentially, the pattern that you see is the same that we saw 4 years ago with the energy price shock after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And that is energy that responds very, very quickly, that feeds into goods inflation, for example, food. And that feeds into headline. Headline peaks more quickly, but underlying and core inflation goes up a little bit more slowly and peaks later. And that is precisely the same pattern that we see as we did 4 years ago, just at a smaller scale compared to 4 years ago when energy inflation went up, I think, 30-40% rather than 10, which is the context that we're talking about right now.
Yeah, and we're looking at unemployment in the 6% range for the euro area and also the EU as a whole.
Rebecca, on unemployment, that's actually a very interesting topic where I wanted to spend some more time on later, because the Commission is dedicating a good amount of pages to that, including in special boxes and whatnot. And I think their take is that the labor market could be at a turning point. So for years and years and years, people were too pessimistic on the European labor market. And it is true that unemployment rate is still essentially at or close to all-time lows. But the point is, maybe we are at a point where some first indications are popping up that the labor market is going to weaken a little bit. And so there's a special box on that topic also. We can talk about that a little bit later. So still good, but maybe just about hanging on.
So those are the big three. We've got weaker than previously forecast growth, higher than previously expected inflation, and unemployment that is hanging on, but not looking so hot. Mahmoud, you have so much experience analyzing economies. What does this tell you about where Europe is, and should we be worried a lot?
Thank you, Rebecca. And well, let me start where Andreas left off. I think we are looking at, obviously, at a weaker outlook. And I want to focus on a couple of things. One is, as with other forecasters, the Commission also gives you one of their adverse scenarios, which is a bit weaker than the baseline that Andreas covered. Bearing in mind that the conflict has now gone on longer than many expected, but more importantly, it is now beyond where the cutoff assumptions were for when the Commission produced this forecast. So we need to think about, are we on track for the baseline, or are we kind of veering towards their adverse scenario, which is a little bit weaker? And growth would be 0.7% in that adverse scenario. And instead of 1.1 that Andreas mentioned, then inflation would be a little higher. We're not going to be able to resolve this now. We all know this conflict is going on longer. We don't quite know when it ends. There are signs that energy prices are stabilizing as prospects for peace and a longer ceasefire seem to be increasing, but we still don't know. What stands out for me is two things, and really the direction and the qualitative assessment that the Commission is providing of how to think about the forecast is, I believe, broadly correct, and I would agree with it, and I want to elaborate on a little bit of that. One is that clearly higher inflation is inevitable. Energy prices that Andreas mentioned, much of it is baked in, and even in the event of a near-term resolution of the Strait of Hormuz and a ceasefire, disruptions to supply chains, trade, etc., we will see lingering effects on inflation. So inflation is not going to kind of go away. But the Commission's assessment of what is the main driver of growth is, I think, spot on. And it's actually quite important in the EU context to discuss this, which is consumption is still the main driver. On the positive side, we have two things. We have household balance sheets are very healthy and saving rates are high. But consumption spending, both of these things have been true, household saving, healthy household balance sheets and saving rates reasonably high, have been true for the last 2 years. And consumption spending was expected to increase, not just by the Commission, but also by the ECB. And that's been a bit disappointing. The Commission, rightly, in my view, worries now about what this new shock does. In particular, it worries that real incomes will not keep up, meaning wage growth, nominal wage growth will not keep up with inflation. This is also a mirror image of what Andreas mentioned, that signs of labor market weakening now, the progress we've seen kind of could stall now. The uncertainty the Commission worries about is also important. The uncertainty, what it does to confidence, what that does to household spending. In particular, what we've seen in Europe is you end up seeing an increase in savings. Even though household balance sheets may be healthy, the saving rates will stay high, precautionary saving, and so on. We have other shocks, like this whole shock reduces global growth. Higher energy prices directly reduce real income, and higher borrowing costs, etc., reduce investment. The higher borrowing costs and the financial conditions tightening, in my view, the Commission is a little bit, in this baseline forecast, a little bit sanguine. It doesn't see a very marked tightening in financial conditions, but the jury's out on that. They may end up being correct. So I don't want to kind of dwell on that. But all those factors I've just mentioned are a drag on demand, and quite a few are a drag on domestic demand, which is why I worry that this mechanism, which I think is correct that the Commission is identifying, could give us a weaker outlook than their baseline. So we could be in the adverse scenario. And in particular, if I had to single out, I think it is a very, very high probability that wage growth will not keep up with inflation for the next year or so. This is very hard to see how wage growth. Firms do not have enough pricing power to give in to wage demand. The ECB's wage tracker is still showing very moderate wage growth this year. And that, I think, will give us a weaker outlook. So I would think we're somewhere between what their baseline is, which I would right now class as optimistic, to what they give us as their adverse scenario. And the ECB, as you know, Andreas mentioned this, has gone a little bit further by adverse plus a severe stress scenario. And we still don't know where we'll end up because the conflict hasn't ended and we don't have definitive signs of peace. Let me stop there, Rebecca, and maybe follow up on where you want to go next.
Can I jump in for that? Just one second. Because I think just to really extend what Mahmoud just said, I think what we're seeing over the last sort of 6 weeks is essentially institutions catching up with reality in their forecasts. And nobody knows how long the altercations in the Middle East will continue. And so essentially what we've seen, and you know, take inflation as an example, the ECB in the March projection had headline revised from 1.9 to 2.6 in 2026. Now, at this point, we're already 6 weeks hence in the whole process. And so the commission can say, well, we actually think that inflation energy is going to be worse than what the ECB thought at the time. And so we can revise it up further. And so we'll see a continuation of this. So the point I'm trying to make is that this is not a projection or forecast that is a turning point. It's a continuation, an extension of a bad scenario that continues to get worse as long as the conflict continues. It will drag inflation higher and it will drag growth lower simply as long as the geopolitical situation stays as is. And that's the key assumption in all of this. How long does this continue? When does it come to an end? When does the energy price shock fade? And that is really what we're seeing here. So essentially a time extension. And we'll see that again in 3 weeks from the ECB when they'll catch up with reality in their own forecast.
A steady downward slide as long as global conditions don't improve seems to be what we're looking at. When I look at the country by country tables, it jumps out that the euro area's big economies, Germany and Italy notably, have the slowest growth. I'm going to toss out Ireland as an outlier because they have some weird effects with trying to sell all their pharmaceuticals ahead of the U.S. tariffs. So how worried should we be that the big powerhouse economies are also the slowest growing? And if we continue this steady downward slide, are they going to end up in recession and bring the rest of the euro area down with them?
Now, just to bring the numbers to the table. So again, going back to the sort of the sequential point that I made earlier that is important to look at here, Germany is actually now in the May forecast is expected to shrink by 0.2% in the second quarter of this year and to be flat then essentially for the rest of the year. So Germany ends up because of carryover at a 0.6, but that's a pretty significant downward revision from what they had in November last year, which was 1.2 for Germany. So the biggest revision, the most, you know, not the biggest revision itself, but the most significant revision given the weight of the country comes from Germany. And there essentially, there's two opposing effects. One is sort of the fiscal stimulus coming out of Germany, but that essentially in many ways got stopped in the tracks by yet another energy shock. And with Germany being more exposed to energy shocks than some of the other countries, for example, the Iberian Peninsula, it just hurts a little bit more. I would highlight one other thing in this context, again, on Germany. And that is that in November, the commission still thought that potential growth in Germany was actually increasing, was going from 0.4 to 0.6. They have now dropped that notion. And I think that is a quite concerning fact. Now, you know, that might come back into forecast in 6 months' time. But for now, I think that's a key element that makes me quite nervous, not about the forecast itself, but about the economic outlook.
I would just add one line to that, which is, Rebecca, I would add France to your list as well. And one thing I would say is, in the large economies, France, Italy, Germany. Germany, we understand, as Andreas points to, the underlying fiscal support coming from the defense infrastructure envelope. But in the other economies, there is very little likelihood of any substantial fiscal support. There are all marginal measures of capping some energy prices and so on, but any substantial fiscal support this time is going to be lacking. Indeed, the Commission's forecast basically does not rely on any material fiscal support coming to support growth this year. So obviously, it would not be anyone's baseline at this point to be forecasting an area-wide recession this year. But we should not rule it out, given that we're still so uncertain about the length of the conflict and the potential disruptions, etc. We should not rule it out. So I think you bring up a good point. It's not something the ECB or the Commission or anyone else is forecasting at this point, but we will get close. And especially as Andreas mentions, on a sequential basis, once you take away figures that early part of the year, first quarter growth figures that are already baked in, on a sequential basis, we could easily head into a recession.
It's certainly on the mind of many voters in a lot of countries, and there's a real perception that things are more expensive and that things are harder now because of, I guess, all of this uncertainty and firms waiting to make hiring and wage decisions. Can we talk a little bit about the non-Euro EU countries? Poland, still a strong performer. We've also got Sweden, Denmark, Czechia looking to do maybe not blindingly fast growth, but ahead of some of these big Euro area engines. How important is that?
I think, you know, in the end, some of these countries, looking at it from an aggregate perspective, some of these countries obviously matter a lot, some are just a bit smaller. I think Poland is an interesting case in point, and that is where clearly you still have a good growth dynamic. So that's a good point that you bring up there. I think obviously some of the countries in the non-Eurozone EU are quite important simply because they are large, and Poland would be one of them. Poland is still expected to continue to grow quite significantly. That has partly to do also with the fact that one of the major recipients, obviously, of Next Generation EU funds. So GDP growth continues to be quite strong in this projection at 3.5% and then only fading in 2027 a little bit to just shy of 3%. I mean, I think you see that clearly an investment that's going to drop off, that's going to peak this year and then drop off next year, again, very likely to be related to EU fund usage. So, you know, the countries in Central Eastern Europe typically grow a little bit faster, but also have somewhat higher inflation. And I think this projection here is not very different from previous projections in this context.
Mahmoud, given how much of this overall trend is driven by the external factor of this war that Europe did not start and is not part of, I'm thinking of the one in Iran as opposed to the one on its front ongoing between Russia and Ukraine. But these are not policy decisions being made in Brussels or Paris or Frankfurt. How much is Europe stuck just reacting, and how much can they actually do to try and improve their prospects?
Oh, I think in the near term, you know, there is very little you can do to the energy price shock beyond what I'm sure behind the scenes there are efforts going on to try and support the resolution, ceasefire, peace process. But you're right, Europe is not the main actor here. Like other parts of the world, it's just suffering from this global energy trade disruption shock, and there's very little you can do to that. I think in the near term, by that I mean in the next year or so, even if there was a reasonable ceasefire in the next few months, the repercussions of that will linger on for a while. And it's just managing and shielding growth as best you can. And that varies by countries' fiscal space issues, etc. This is a real shock. It's a terms of trade shock. So much of it will require a real adjustment, and it's very hard to get away from the growth implications of that. Beyond that, I think there are lessons. Energy security, Europe's efforts to reduce reliance. There are some encouraging signs, by the way. It's not all depressing. The oil intensity of European growth has declined very substantially. That path of becoming less dependent on old fossil energy imports, etc., moving towards more renewable and so on, it's difficult to pursue that with vigor when you're in the middle of a real shock. So we're seeing some subsidies, some caps on, you know, excise duties being taken off and trying to protect the consumer from excessive rises in energy prices and so on. But the lesson is that the longer term goal, we should not forget that this is something that we should keep pursuing. So that's, in a way, what Europe can take away as an important lesson from this, reinforces what Europe already has a strategy for, to move to renewables and to keep on that path, however difficult it might be, in politically, however difficult it might be in the short term. Lots of climate net zero ambitions have been scaled down. Governments are being a little bit more pragmatic, not going as fast as the various targets, various agreements, but hopefully they don't lose sight of it.
I just want to add a little bit to what Mahmoud said. I think, including because the Commission dedicates a good amount of space to some of these issues. So for one, there is a marked difference between where we are now and where we were in 2022. The simple way to show this is that the merit order is a lot less dominated by natural gas, which means that essentially the electricity price is lower. And that's also a cross-country finding, that in countries where is more renewables and natural gas is less often the decisive factor, that electricity prices are lower, including to the consumer. So the point that the Commission makes here is that two things happen. One is that, the transition, but two is also that simply demand fell quite a bit. Now, that is partly for good reasons and partly for bad reasons, as we all know. The good reason is that households maybe diversified a little bit away and sort of became a little bit more careful in their energy consumption. And that is, among other things, an effect of the price signal. And the other one is that simply some industrial users that did use energy in the past do not use it any longer. And that is to do with the fact that Europe is just not competitive in terms of energy prices on the supply side. So we know that in Germany, the energy intensive industry, in that energy intensive industrial production is still something like 16 or 17% below the 2019 levels, I want to say, or 2020 levels. So clearly there's a change in the industrial tissue also ongoing. And so I think the point here is to say that, to tying it back to what Mahmoud said, is that the fiscal reaction function compared to 2022 is an order of magnitude smaller than what it was at the time. That might be just a little bit of good luck, but it also might be because governments just realized that there's not enough fiscal largesse to throw around as there was at the time when growth interest rate differential worked in Europe's favor, and it doesn't do that any longer. So, you know, these are dire fiscal times, and there's no money to be wasted, in particular if it is wasted, which it was largely at the time on measures that were not particularly targeted, and which is also the case now. So the measures that we have seen so far, two-thirds of them are not targeted, and that is obviously not the best possible outcome. So I think less fiscal, we'll see, partly for need, and you know, but that's also not a bad thing in many ways, because it doesn't endanger the fiscal position even more.
I just want to reinforce one point on that, which is what Andreas touched on. Comparing it with the 2022 energy price shock, especially gas and so on, I think we can at least at this point say, well, Europe is fortunate that the shock is not as large. If the shock in 2022, the fiscal lesson we have all come away that fiscal support should be targeted and so on. But in 22, if governments had targeted fiscal support in the way a lot of policymakers now say that was a kind of possibly a mistake, whatever, we shouldn't have done that. The inflation consequences of that would have been very, very severe, because the energy price shock was so large at that time that you would have had very high inflation and central banks needing to react a lot more aggressively than they did. So I think it's very fortunate that this shock, at least so far, is nowhere near that large. If we get a repeat of 2022, despite all of us agreeing that fiscal support should be targeted, that may not be feasible, because the inflation consequences of that would have been very, very much higher than they were in 2022. So that's just a kind of caution about fiscal support is sometimes conditional on the size of the shock, not just what is desirable.
It's an important point, because if you end up sparking inflation with something that you're trying to do to help the economy get better, that's sort of the opposite of what you were trying to get. Before we start talking about the future, Andreas, tell us more about the job situation. You said you had picked out some things in the boxes and the trends, and I'd like to hear more about what you thought about that.
I think the main point that the Commission is making in the dedicated research, let me step back for a second. So typically these reports, and it's not only this one, it's pretty much any report of a large international organization, be it the ECB, be it the Commission, be it the IMF, typically it's worthwhile looking at the boxes and sort of the special features, because that gives you really an impression where the policy discussion is. That's where the meat of the conversation. And so here, going back to what I said earlier, for years and years, I think people were too pessimistic on the European labor market. Everybody was surprised how low unemployment rates could go and how strong, you know, job formation actually was over the last 3-4 years, really, coming out of the pandemic. And so the Commission essentially asks the question, well, you know, how come? And are we slowly coming to a turning point? And I think the idea here is that you see some indications, and in particular, it's the hiring rates that are slowing. And that ultimately means a softening labor market. That can be, for a while, not necessarily have a strong impact, in particular because, you know, there's still strong job creation, because you had labor shortages that are slowly only peeling off. You have better matching, for example, in labor markets. That's a hypothesis that is heavily discussed right now, that even though the hiring intentions are not as strong, people are matched better, and that's why you don't see an impact on the unemployment rate yet. You see people talking about hoarding again, which was the narrative during the pandemic, if you recall. But the bottom line is that really that slower hiring will have an effect on unemployment sooner or later. And you probably see it first in the marginally attached in the labor market. And so the transition rates from unemployed into inactive and employed and from inactive into those other groups, that is what matters. And that is where we're watching right now. And that clearly speaks to a softening labor market. So far, no, nothing dramatic here, but clearly the labor market has passed its peak in terms of spec.
In the second half of this podcast, I'd like to talk about the interaction between the EU and the rest of the world, the big differences between the fortunes of some European countries and some other ones. And also, what are the policy prescriptions that we will want to pursue going forward? Like, what can we do about all of this to help the economy weather the shocks and grow better? So maybe let's start with the rest of the world. And the big ones are the US and also the UK. I'm going to leave aside China here because it's in a different category and there are so many more considerations. So I want to talk about the EU's main trading partners and main peers in its general sphere. Like, what does it mean that EU growth is so slow? And what are we seeing in comparison to the US, which has this booming stock market, but also so much political risk and so much uncertainty?
I'm happy to start with a couple of issues. I think you're right. Let's focus start with the US. One is, look, healthy growth in the US is positive for everyone, pretty much. Okay. So let's not kind of quibble about that. That's not, you know, of course, how sustainable it is and what it's built on, so on, there are some risks. Okay. I mean, the fiscal stimulus in the US is excessive. And at some point, that's a worry. How long the AI investment boom lasts, those are two big drivers of what's going on in the US, including US markets and so on. But broadly speaking, that's positive. What is worrying for the EU is a possible return of trade tension and some expression from the US administration that trade tensions will, they're not happy with the current trade deal and whether that's related to the EU lack of support or incomplete support for this US-Iran conflict. I'll tell, that's a little bit worrying because even though many thought the deal last year wasn't great, but at least there was a deal and there was a return to some sort of calm on the trade front. If we open that again, that's a big worry, what's happening in the U.S. And now that's directly a function not of the U.S. economy, it's just a function of the current stance of the U.S. administration. Obviously, there are many initiatives and many question marks, many pointers, what the EU needs to do in various fronts in terms of its own reform efforts, whether it's the Draghi report was another report in a whole line of reports that identified some of the weaknesses and some of the issues that need to be addressed, particularly deregulation and so on. I think those are slow-moving things that Europe needs to speed up on a little bit. I would say on the US, my current worry would be whether we kind of return to some trade tensions, because that would be very negative, especially in this period when Europe's exports are being squeezed from both sides. You mentioned China, but you know, China is a very, very big issue for European exports. And net exports to China are now falling and not positive anymore. So it's like, it's a worry. The US has traditionally been a very big market for EU exports. That's a worry. And that's another drag on growth in Europe, a demand drag. Let me stop there on the US.
Yeah, let me add maybe that I would come from a different side. I would probably stress and I'm surprised Mahmoud didn't do that given what IMF stands for. I would stress the fiscal side of things. So the point here being that, and this is going back to the forecast by the Commission, and you know, it's not that this is massively different from any other forecast I've seen. The Commission has the U.S. grow at just around 2%, maybe a touch higher this year and next, at a fiscal deficit of 7.5% going to 8%. And with private consumption supported more than in any other country by wealth that is formed in the stock market and shows up in 401ks and is a significant factor in household consumption decisions. So the risk is clearly that you have a stock market correction, that feeds into domestic consumption. and that GDP growth falters, that is one way this can happen. And there's a question about sort of AI investment and allocative decisions here, whether all these billions and trillions invested will come to a good end. And the other question is simply whether a market reaction in fixed income markets at some point will continue, where you have a continued steepening of yield curves and where borrowing becomes ever more expensive, including in the US. And so that at some point might force a adjustment of the deficit. And, you know, again, it's not that we're talking smalls here, right? So just by comparison, the European Union is at 3.5% of GDP versus the US at 7.5% this year, I believe, and 8% next year or something like that. So the point is here, that's a fiscal risk. And I do think that that is a very significant one. And I would put that center, because also the global transmission then in terms of rates markets is essentially instant. That is sort of the biggest risk that I have on my watch.
What about the UK? Fiscal space has been a huge issue for their economy, which has struggled politically and, surprisingly to me anyway, in the markets. I wouldn't have expected the UK to flirt with as much bond market doom as it has the last couple of years. What's their relationship with the EU like now? And is their own economic teeter-totter why we're seeing more proposals about ways to get economically closer with Brussels?
On the UK, there is a wider increasing recognition, and is spreading it a little bit across the political spectrum, especially among voters, not necessarily among the positions of the main political parties, a recognition that Brexit has been costly. Brexit has, you know, there are various estimates coalescing around 7-8% of GDP as a sort of stock effect. And that has sort of impact on obviously lower growth, but which lower growth also then kind of feeds back into the fiscal constraints, etc. Now, it's politically too difficult to envisage a closer relation, meaningfully closer relation, until the next election. From what it looks like is the two large parties on the right of the center will still be very, very opposed to any re-entry. They're even scared of any closer ties short of re-entry because of what compromises the UK would need to make, European Court of Justice and so things like that. Interestingly, it is possible that the current government, if there is a change of leadership, the Prime Minister is replaced by one of the contenders, it is possible that one of those contenders might actually stand on a platform to rejoin the single market. Just a possibility. I would summarize it by a recognition that Brexit has been costly. That's getting a lot more traction. And secondly, the beginnings of entertaining the idea of forming closer ties, maybe eventually even rejoining. Now, of course, that's not entirely just dependent on the UK stance. It depends on the EU as well. But it's early days yet. You know, in the next year or two, I don't see anything material happening. There may be some closer ties, cooperation on defense, etc. And that's kind of a positive, at least in terms of relations with the EU. They're more constructive, especially given the Russia-Ukraine situation, the higher defense commitment on the part of all the NATO allies because of what push from the US and so on. It's actually making relations more positive, more friendly, etc., more constructive because of the defense procurement, etc. But I haven't mentioned things like the single market and things like that, which are the material things for reviving UK growth prospects. I think it's early days on that yet.
Yeah, I do find it notable that the UK would love to get more benefits from closer relations with the EU, but is not yet ready to cross any of its own red lines. And the EU is very understandably saying, bring us a proposal when you have one, not just a general desire for things to be better, which of course is represented in the UK media as Brussels rejecting the UK, which is another thing.
Rebecca, I just say you have to start with, let's be friends again. At least that's a beginning.
You know, we got to get the sentiment going. But I do take issue with the British media saying that Brussels is rejecting these proposals when there isn't a proposal yet. We're just sort of working our way up to it. What about Europe to bring it back. All of the proposals for growth, competitiveness, fill in your buzzword, Draghi report, Letta report, the other reports, they all say we need to reduce fragmentation. We need to boost up the single market, join up our capital market, get more investment, get better pensions. And yet we have a European Union and a euro area where certain countries are doing much better by some measures than other countries. This varies depending on what you're looking at. And there's a reluctance for people to give up or have a perception of giving up the things that are working for them. So what are your broad policy prescriptions for the EU and what are your realistic ones?
I can start on that. Just on the UK, pour a touch of cold water on sort of the marginally optimistic theme that that you developed there. I think just politically, we're not even close to any of this, in the sense that the party that has been gaining in the polls and has been a big success at the local elections, none of the voters is going to vote for that party based on a platform that is more EU-friendly. And so I think we first need to come to a turning point on that. Next general elections is 3 years away, so I have a very hard time seeing anything meaningful in terms of, bits and bobs, but anything meaningful that smells of a closer relationship between the EU and the UK inside of 8 years. I have a very hard time seeing that. That might be too pessimistic. I hope so, in the sense that I think it would be obviously mutually beneficial, make some progress, but politically, I think I'm still not quite convinced that this is feasible. Now, I think going back to what you said, Rebecca, what you asked, ultimately, I think what we see is that countries do better that have a more rapidly increasing cake to distribute. And that is nothing new. That is old hat, so to say. And so I think ultimately what you need to bring to the table is growth. And with growth, then you can spend money. But if growth is not there, then it's really a fight over the pieces of the cake rather than the freedom to distribute more cake to stay in the picture. And so I think what we see in countries where things seem to be going a little bit better is still convergence growth. You remember the term beta convergence from way back when in the days when we discussed growth in Central Eastern Europe. And, these things are still the case. Now, obviously, there's infrastructure. There is a question about the role of the state. There's all sorts of elements here. But, ultimately, to me, it does come back to growth because that is fundamentally driving most of these things. Also, in terms of sort of a sociopolitical piece, and that helps with sort of economic stability in and of itself. I'm happy to go into more detail, but maybe let me stop there because that's a wide open topic.
I would just add one thing. By the way, I agree with Andreas. I'm not like saying that UK re-entry is in a 3-year, 5-year horizon. It's not. But I'm just saying, and as I said, I agree with Andreas that the next election is critical. But I think the next 3 years, a lot could change in terms of the relative support that the various parties are attracting at this point. And that's a... Secondly, let me just turn to Europe as your question now. I think one thing to avoid is the risk of further fragmentation when you end up with shocks such as this one. At least that would be a kind of good result at the end if Europe can avoid any further. But on fragmentation, if you look at the underlying issues such as spreads on government debt and so on, Europe in the last 2 years has done very, very well. Okay? This is not something we have worried about, at least in sovereign. And you hope that this kind of shock doesn't open up that can of worms again, right? Because those are hard things to deal with. And secondly, on a more kind of constructive relative to all the reports and so on, the recommendations for reforms, etc., I think fundamentally what's holding up Europe is member states still have very, very strong preferences for keeping with many of the regulations which are country-specific, not necessarily in line with EU. I mean, the gold plating and so on, things like that. It's a very fundamental issue when it comes to things like integrating capital markets. It's been holding up integration of capital markets, or the capital markets union, savings investment union now, for a long time, which is why you end up with proposals such as can we have a 28th regime that countries can sign up to, et cetera, not sort of kind of conform, make everyone's regime the same. This is not a very productive avenue, in my view. I think ultimately Europe has to sort of decide something more existential. Does it want to be a union with lots of uniform regulations? It fundamentally speaks to, it's not making the most of its single market. When real investors, foreign or corporations look at Europe, they don't see a single market. They see many different markets. If they could see a single market, then the expected return on investment would be a lot higher and you would attract more investment. I don't think it's the supply of capital or supply of savings that's ever been Europe's problem. I know too much of it sits in bank deposits and not in market instruments, etc. There are pensions issues, so on. But the expected return on investment is, I think, the biggest challenge. And that expected return is too low because the market is fragmented. It's not a single market. That would be the big game changer. It's a tall challenge, but it's something that would need to be addressed before we, for longer term prospects on growth.
It all comes back to growth, doesn't it? We need better growth to attract more investment. We need better growth to reduce the inequalities. We need better growth to, as Andreas said, have more cake to distribute to more public good and more projects. We're coming to the end of our time. Love to hear from each of you if there's anything super important you think we haven't talked about yet and should, or if there's one key idea you'd like listeners to walk away with.
Yeah, Rebecca, I mean, I think it is important to always watch the boxes, as I may have already mentioned. And the Commission in this forecast also presents a special, which is around the topic of AI and AI adoption. And they do that on the back of a survey that they ran, I think, in February and March. And ultimately, the question is, what is the impact of AI on productivity? And I think, there are many views out here, but the evidence is scarce. And this is not evidence, right? So again, just to repeat, this is based on a survey that they ran. And typically, also, a lot of people look at this on a firm perspective, but the survey that they ran is actually on a worker perspective. So what do individuals do? Do they use AI? And, they find that 50% do use AI. But that about half of that, only half of that use it for work, and the rest uses it for leisure or mixed use. Now, one highlight from that survey that I wanted to point out is that so far AI is actually not helping to close the digital divide, in the sense that the people that are more likely to use it are the young, well-qualified, and those in managerial roles. So that doesn't really help with the digital divide. They find that there are time savings of about 7 hours a month. So I can break that down in 4.5% efficiency gain. And then you do some fancy math and it takes you to just shy of 1% of additional total factor productivity, which is more aligning with sort of the more pessimistic spectrum of people looking at this. Now, the one finding that I found particularly interesting was that higher AI users, again, we're talking about individuals, not about firms, that they report lower perceived benefits. Again, keyword is perceived, so we don't really know how that scales from an individual to a corporate level. But the way to look at this, at least for now, is that this might be evidence of somewhat decreasing returns to scale of AI. So if the people that use it more find lower perceived benefits, then, that is not really what I would have expected from that type of service. I found that an interesting finding. Now, the flip side is, and that is sort of something that the survey also shows, is that lots of people are concerned with job displacement. And so that is, I think, 40% or so are somewhat very concerned with job displacement. And that goes above 60% for certain sectors and certain job descriptions that are, prone to mechanization and sort of where AI would have a very significant impact. Zooming out from what the Commission said, I think the jury is still out. We don't really see a massive drop in labor demand for AI specialists. So the point is that lots of engineering demand is still high and increasing. So I think one cannot conclude that AI is currently a threat to jobs. And historically, general purpose technologies have typically enhanced job creation in fields that were not really there before that GST came to bear. So yeah, so this is just something I wanted to highlight because I think, again, it's a special topic that the Commission covers here, and it's obviously also very much en vogue these days to have a view on this. And they seem to be coming out a little bit more on the skeptical side of things. And I think it's also true that in many of the European projections and forecasts, economic forecasts, both this one, but also the ECB, there's not really a lot of AI baked into the proverbial cake in terms of growth. Let me sit there.
One sort of key takeaway is this is a pretty big global shock. Well known, everyone will tell you this is a very big shock in terms of trade for Europe, for the UK, because we're energy importers, unlike the US. When you look at all the forecasts, I'm encouraged that the forecasters at this point are not forecasting a recession. If we can get away without a recession, I think that would be a good outcome. We're innocent bystanders. If we can get away without a recession, that's a problem.
I would agree with that. I think ultimately what I mentioned earlier is that the key determinant and what we're seeing now in sort of this wave of forecast revisions between IMF a month ago, the Commission now, the ECB in 3 weeks, is really just marking to market our expectations on the war. And the longer it goes on, the closer we're getting to Mahmoud's scenario of a marginal recession. But for now, I think it's another example of where, and we've seen this last year after the trade shock, the tariff shock in the US, where economies are probably a bit more resilient than what we expected them to be. Now, this is partly based on very tricky modeling because we haven't seen some of these shocks in a long time. I mean, energy 22 and 26 are major shocks that haven't happened in 50 years. The tariff shock last year was a shock that we haven't seen in, 100 years, where actually we don't even have the data to fit the models. So point is, the economies are more resilient than we probably give them credit. But fact is that it makes life a lot more complicated than what it would be without those shocks. Let's put it this way.
Thank you so much. You've been listening to The Sound of Economics from Bruegel. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, and I have been joined today by my amazing colleagues, Mahmoud Pradhan and Andreas Billmeyer. This has been a rare occasion to really talk about what's going on now with the EU economy and not just long-term principles or recent research, but really like, where are we? What's the stock take? So I hope you've stuck around and enjoyed the journey. You can find all of Bruegel's recent research and reports on our website, Bruegel.org, and you can find this podcast on all your favorite podcast channels. Thanks for listening and see you next time.